Yeah, we had a break last week, so we're reconvening for the second half of the semester. So we were talking about type services, so we're going to continue to talk about type services. So what we've done so far is to come up with a way of describing type services. You know, there are defining equations for that. We can find the normal vector from the defining equation. We can find tangential vectors. We can decompose, we can put volume elements on the hypersurfaces. We've dealt with all the subtleties that that we find in the null case. And what I want to do today is to continue this, and I want to talk about other issues. And what I'll do for the remainder of this chapter and for the next probably couple of weeks is to now focus entirely on the time-like and space-like case and not exclude the null case. We've dealt with that. We have the tools that we're going to need later on to deal with event horizons. I don't need to return to that. But I want to bring up some other issues that are really relevant and interesting for the either the time-like case for a hypersurface that would evolve in time, or the space-like case, a hypersurface that represents a moment in time. And what I want to do today is talk essentially about intrinsic versus extrinsic curvature. And the issue is this. So I'm going to, for the purposes of this lecture and maybe this afternoon, I'll focus on the case where the hypersurface is actually space-like, although anything that I do and all the math that I do could be generalized, changed very slightly, and I'll say where to handle the time-like case, but I am excluding the null case. So for concreteness, we're going to be talking about the space-like surface. And we know how to describe these, and we know that we can set up coordinate system on the hypersurface. And according to that coordinate system, we're going to have curves running on the surface, and we're going to have tangential vectors that are going to be tangent to those curves. And so we have defining equations, either in this form or in parametric form, like this. YA are the coordinates that are intrinsic to the surface, and X alpha, of course, are the space-time coordinates. We have tangent vectors, which are partial derivatives of the space-time coordinates with respect to the intrinsic coordinates. And we have normal vector, of course, which is proportional for normalization purposes to the gradient of the scalar function phi that defines the surface. And we've seen that from the tangential vectors, we can form an induced metric, the metric that refers to displacements that are entirely contained on the hypersurface. And we get the induced metric by just projecting down to the hypersurface the space-time metric with the basis vectors on the hypersurface. And the issue I want to talk about today is this. So given that we have a manifold, three-dimensional manifold on our, we have a hypersurface that is a manifold with a metric. The metric that's inherited from the space-time metric is HAB. We can treat this, this hypersurface like we would treat any manifold with a metric. And according to that metric, there would be a notion of connection that will be compatible to that metric. There's going to be a covariant derivative that's going to be compatible with that metric. There's going to be a curvature tensor, a Riemann curvature tensor, that's going to be three-dimensional and will refer only to that three-dimensional metric. And all of those notions that we know about when we deal with curved manifolds exist purely on the three-dimensional manifold that we're dealing with here. And that is what I would call the intrinsic notions of metric, connection, and curvature. And those are well defined, and we can, once we have the metric, we can compute everything that we know about on this three-dimensional map. The issue I want to discuss is how those intrinsic notions of curvature and connection relate to the ones that are inherited from the four-dimensional point of view. So there's a four-dimensional metric, there's a four-dimensional connection, there's a four-dimensional curvature tensor. And there ought to be some relationships between the purely intrinsic notions of curvature and those that are, you know, inherited from the space-time description. And this is what I'm talking about when I say let's compare the intrinsic notions to the ones that come from the outside, from the embedding of the hypersurface in the four-dimensional manifold, and I want to relate these things. And those notions turn out to be extremely important, and there's going to be a notion of extrinsic curvature, some quantity that I'm going to introduce today, called the extrinsic curvature, that plays a very important role in all sorts of different areas of differential geometry and general relativity, and and that will come out from the discussion. In the book, I do it in a certain way where I don't specialize the coordinate system. I'm dealing with an arbitrary coordinate system for the space-time and an arbitrary coordinate system for the hypersurface. What I'm going to do today, because I always like to find different ways of explaining things, what I'll do today is to, in fact, simplify my life by picking a particular coordinate system for the space-time, retaining the freedom of choosing whatever coordinate system we want for that surface. And I'll design a coordinate system that's going to be really well suited to do a lot of computations, and all of those notions that I try to introduce will come out, I think, very clearly that way. Not that it's not clear if you don't specialize the coordinate system, but it's just a different take on all of that. And I think, you know, to have the two takes is something that, you know, if you read both accounts, you can probably get a lot of insight into what I'm trying to do here. So I'll specialize the coordinate system first, but then I'll, you know, try to write all the important results a little bit later in terms of coordinate-free language. So in the end, there's going to be a way of writing out all the important results going back to an arbitrary coordinate system, and I'll indicate how it's done in due course. Where I'm going to be going with all of this is that, this formulation that I'm going to talk about here will allow me to talk about the initial value problem for general relativity, which is all about setting up an appropriate metric and appropriate extrinsic curvature on a three-dimensional hypersurface that is space-like in order to start, an integration of the Einstein field equations. So that's a way of specifying initial values that can then be evolved using the remaining Einstein field equations for the future. That's a very important part of general relativity, and I want to talk about this. Another application that I'll turn to, hopefully if I have time today, is the issue of junction conditions. So suppose that you have two spacetimes and you want to bring them together and join them at a common boundary. What are the appropriate junction conditions that you need to impose in order to have a smooth match? I'll review the situation in electromagnetism where, you know, you have certain conditions on the normal and tangential components of the E field and the B field. Those are well known. There's an analog to this in GR, and the form prism that I'll describe here will allow us to identify what those conditions are. So in that context, the typical situation would concern a time-like boundary between two regions of space-time. In the context of the initial value problem, we really want to consider a space-like surface. So I'll start with the space-like context, but, you know, to go from space-like to time-like just requires a few sign changes here and there, and it's really not difficult to do. So that's where I want to go today, before I get to that, let me remind you that you owe me a homework assignment either this morning or this afternoon, and I have the first one back that I'll distribute at the end of this class. So, we'll deal with that a little bit later. Okay, so what I want to do first is to introduce a convenient coordinate system that will allow me to bring out this relationship between intrinsic notions of metric connection and curvature to the extrinsic notions of these things. And what I'll do is to just essentially make three of my four space-time coordinates agree with the three coordinates that are intrinsic to the hypersurface, and then we'll find a convenient way to extend them off the hypersurface. And the construction is going to be very simple. And the construction that I'm describing here is called Gaussian normal coordinates. Gaussian among Gauss, among many things, is known for his work with surfaces embedded in three-dimensional space. So all of that really goes back to the techniques he first introduced. Not that I've ever read the original articles, but that's what I'm told by reading textbooks on this. So I'm just going to copy this diagram over here, but now I'm going to extend it above and below the hypersurface. And the idea is something like this. So we're going to retain the curves that are the curves of constant y, and we're going to stick to, so we have complete freedom in choosing coordinates intrinsic to the hypersurface, so I'm retaining that freedom. But what I'm going to do is to actually specify the space-time coordinates in terms of those. So as I said, three of my space-time coordinates are going to be in agreement with the intrinsic coordinates of the hypersurface, but I have to find a way of extending them away from the hypersurface a little bit above and a little bit below. I'm going to be working in the neighborhood of the hypersurface, but I need to go off the hypersurface. And the idea is something like this. I have those curves that are intrinsic to the hypersurface. I have normal direction everywhere on the hypersurface. So what I'm going to do is, at each point in the hypersurface, I'm going to go in the normal direction off from the hypersurface, and I'm going to draw a curve that's going to be in that direction. So for example, here's a point that's located at a certain coordinate position on the hypersurface, and I'm going to extend the curve, I'm going to draw a curve, I'm going to shoot a curve off from the hypersurface in the normal direction. So I have one curve like this, I have another curve over here. And each curve goes off either above or below the hypersurface, and it goes off in the normal direction. And what I'm going to demand here is that a point that's going to be off of the hypersurface that's going to be along that curve is going to have the same y-coordinates as the point on the hypersurface. So those curves that I'm drawing here are going to be curves ya equal constant in space-time. And each curve is going to be labeled by the y-coordinate from the point of origin. And that's the way that I can continue my spatial coordinates from the hypersurface above and below the hypersurface. That's the construction. So this is the curve ya equal constant. This is another curve ya equal constant. So and the y coordinate of this point and the y coordinate. So the y coordinate of this point is the same as this one, and same thing here. And basically, we have a whole bunch of curves like this. They each go into the normal direction, and they each carry with them the value of the y-coordinate at the point of origin. So that's how I extend my spatial coordinates off away from the hypersurface. And the only thing I have to do now is to pick time coordinate, or a coordinate that, that describes displacements away from the hypersurface. And here, there are certain choices that could be made, but a plausible, convenient choice would be to choose proper time along each one of those curves. So the time coordinate that I'm going to be introducing here is just going to be a proper time along each one of those curves. So t is going to be proper time on curves y8 equal constant. And we're going to agree that t equals 0 is the point of origin, so the surface in space-time is going to be described by statement t equals 0. So the hypersurface then becomes a surface of constant time. Time has t equals 0, and the time coordinate has essentially been constructed, given the hypersurface. So in the end, we have that the space-time coordinates are going to be, well, the time coordinate that I've just selected here, time as measured along each curve, and then the y-a coordinates. And we're going to have a metric in that space-time. The metric of the space-time in the neighborhood of the hypersurface, or ds squared in the neighborhood of the hypersurface, is going to have minus dt squared. That's the displacement that I get when I go along the curve. And then there's going to be a bit that will represent the displacement in the directions that are orthogonal to the curves. And the construction guarantees that there's no that there won't be any cross terms dt dy, at least not in the neighborhood of the hypersurface. And that's because, you know, those curves are pointing in the normal direction. So the beauty of this coordinate system is that, well, it gives us a block diagonal description of the metric. We have a time entry, which is very simple, by choosing time to be proper time on the curves. And we don't have any cross curves because we choose the coordinates to be adapted to curves that are orthogonal to the hypersurface. And that gives us a very, the metric depends on time. It also depends on coordinates, obviously. And we have the additional statement that if we evaluate the spatial metric at t equals 0, well, we get back the induced metric that fits on hypersurface. Again, that's guaranteed by the construction. So that's the space-time coordinates that I'm going to be dealing with, and that's the space-time metric that we have in the neighborhood of the hypersurface. If I were dealing with, so here I'm dealing with a space-like surface, so I'm talking about time going off the hypersurface. If I were dealing with a time-like surface, I would be talking about proper distance going off orthogonally to the hypersurface. So the only change that I would make is that, well, instead of calling this t, I would call this s or l or something like that, something that would convey the meaning of spatial distance. And the only difference that would occur in the metric would be that, well, this minus dt squared would become plus dl squared. And that's, you know, that's where the sign changes will come from. It will come from the fact that the signature of the metric here would be different. So, you know, once you go through the calculation in this case, it's very easy to go through it once more and alter the signs where they're needed. Or you can just do this calculation once and for all by changing this into an epsilon that could take the value plus or minus 1. In either case, it's very straightforward. Okay, so is the construction clear? Yeah.
And the cross term of the hypersurface.
I don't think I can guarantee it at large distances away from the hypersurface. But what I need to do here is to go just a little bit above and below. So so the statement is that, you know, if you think of a Taylor expansion about t equals 0, I'm saying that at the order of, I'm considering that we need to worry about cross terms. Alternatively, what I could do is to guarantee that there will not be cross terms by drawing into another surface. So what I could do is to go a certain distance in t away from each point over here and draw a half surface through that and repeat the construction from there. So I can, in fact, globally extend. So there are two answers. One is where I can actually globally extend this without cross terms by just continuing the construction, you know, as far as I want to push it. And the other statement is, so there's a way to guarantee that, at least in a large neighborhood of that hypersurface. For my purposes, I can just say that I don't want any cross terms, so I don't have any cross terms in a small neighborhood of the hypersurface. That's good enough for what I have.
Okay.
Yep.
Could you imagine a space time where you would run into trouble if you tried to do that forever? I mean,
right.
So
yeah. So that's why you need to work in the neighborhood. You can do this for, you know, up to a certain point, but at some point you start running into trouble,
yeah,
with the curves crossing, that type of surface becoming, you know, badly connected, things like that. So yeah. So you can do this locally. There's no finding that you can do this globally except in hypersymmetric situations like FRW or something like that. So we're all good. Okay, so now that we have the coordinate system, we can um, we have metric, we can go in and calculate stuff. So we can calculate the connection. And we can really start to see the relationship between the Christoffel symbols that we'll get from the full space-time metric and those that we would get purely from the spatial. And that's what I want to do here. And I'll do it for the connection, I'll do it for the curvature. I don't want to go through a lot of calculations because it's all pretty straightforward. Well, I'll just indicate some of the steps just so that you see, you know, what's happening in those calculations. So let's talk about, so we have the coordinate system, we have the space-time metric around our hypersurface. So let's talk about the connections that we have here. And there are two connections that we can talk about. The first connection that I'll talk about is the space-time connection, the one that comes from the four-dimensional metric. And to distinguish it, I'll assign four labels to that. So that's the space-time connection. And that, of course, is compatible with the space-time metric. And of course, this connection gives us a covariant derivative operator, which is also indicated with a semicolon in the standard notation. And then there's the other notion of connection, which will be a purely spatial connection. And I could put three on here, but I won't. And that is the connection that would be generated purely from the spatial deformation. That's the connection that would be compatible with H. So that's the hypersurface connection. And it's compatible with H. And this connection gives us a notion of covariant derivative, which I'll indicate with a different notation is going to be a D notation instead of an absolute notation. And so instead of using a semicolon to indicate this, the operation of covariant derivative, I'll use a stroke, a vertical bar. Okay, so let's calculate the connection. Well, you know how that's done. We have metric, we have the inverse metric. So the metric is in block diagonal form. And that means that, well, it has the entries minus 1, 0, 0, GAD. The inverse metric, well, because we have block diagonal form, we can take the inverse of each block independently. So the entries here are going to be minus 1, 0, 0. And then we'll have the inverse of purely spatial components right here. So the structure of the inverse metric is very simple. And when we calculate the connection, well, let's go through one example. For example, let's calculate one where, so we want to calculate all the components of this, and alpha can take the values t or, you know, a, distinguishing between the time and the spatial direction. So let's start with one, the first one where alpha is equal to t. And I'll keep those indices free for the time being. And if we write this out, normally there would be a free index that would occur here. I would have to solve for that. But here I'm using the point that the inverse metric only has component along t if the other index is also t. So the W index that should be here, in fact, is forced to take the value t. And then we have GT beta comp gamma plus GT gamma comp beta minus GT beta gamma. Sorry, minus G beta gamma comp G. Well, this guy, whatever the value of beta, we get zero because we have to differentiate a T something component of the metric. And you know, the only T something component of the metric we got is GTT, if GTT is minus one. It doesn't vary with anything. So this term is zero, this term is zero as well. Over here, what we see is that, well, the only components of the metric that do depend on time are purely spatial ones. So what we conclude from that is that, well, we get something zero unless beta and gamma are both spatial indices. And the bottom line is that the T spatial spatial components of the connection are to be given by, we have minus one here and we have minus one there, so we get half the time derivative of the spatial metric. So we can proceed like that, continue to calculate all the components, and I'll just list the final results for the other guys. So the other non-zero possibilities are one where you have a spatial index here and a time and spatial index there. And in this case, you get something that looks very similar, except that this needs to involve the inverse spatial metric. And what you have then is the time derivative of the spatial components of the metric again. So you got those. And then finally, you got the fully spatial components. And these look like this. So you get M B comp C plus G M C comp B and minus G B C comma M. And that looks familiar. So those are the components of the connection both on and off the hypersurface. If I now evaluate all of this on the hypersurface, we get something a little cleaner. So on sigma, or at t equals zero, we get that the time space space component of the connection is going to be given by this evaluated on the hypersurface, and I'll invent a notation for this. It's going to be KAB. And KAB is the extrinsic curvature, something that we'll see again and again, a very, very important one. I'll provide it in just a second. We've got those components where what you can do is to take, what I've just called the KAB and raise the index with the spatial metric, but it's the spatial metric evaluated at t equals zero, which means that it's H. And our convention is going to be that we're going to raise our indices when we work on the hypersurface with, of course, its metric. So we've got that. And finally, we get the purely spatial components of four-dimensional connection are equal to the actual connection that we get from the spatial method. Because here, after evaluation of t equals zero, each g becomes an h, and we only worry here about spatial derivatives. So therefore, this evaluated at t equals zero is the connection that will be compatible with the spatial metric. So that's the intrinsic correction connection. That's the space connection. And you see that while those components agree, but those components, of course, bring out new information that's not completely intrinsic for the metric. With KAB, that brings information about the rate of change of the metric as we go through the hypersurface. So KAB and our calculation is defined to be I absorbed a factor of 1/2 here. So KAB is 1/2 the time derivative of the spatial components of the metric evaluated at t equals zero. And KAB by convention with the index up is, you know, raise the index with the metric appropriate on the hypersurface. All right. KAP, well, you can see right away, is metric tensor on the hypersurface. But it brings information about things that live off the hypersurface because it's constructed from the time derivative of the metric. And this is a definition that, you know, comes in our particular coordinate construction. This quantity is so important that we're going to need to provide for definitions that are not, you know, necessarily relying on coordinate construction. And I'll come to that later. The extrinsic curvature is extremely important, as I said. I put curvature in quotations because I don't mean to suggest that this is something analogous to a Riemann tensor. It doesn't have the right units for being a Riemann tensor. You know, it's 1 over length as opposed to 1 over length squared. So its curvature is a slightly different sense from what we normally mean. And basically, it's the thing that tells us not about, you know, intrinsic notions of curvature. It's something that tells us about how the surface is actually bending in the overlying, you know, embedded manifold. Okay, so we get that. Let's go one more step, and from the connection that we computed here, let's compute the curvature tensor. And here, well, the calculations are a bit more, you know, involved because you have to look at, you know, derivative of gamma minus derivative of gamma plus gamma squared stuff. I mean, it's a long calculation. But, you know, we have all the components of the connection here, so everything is pretty straightforward. So I won't go through the calculations in class, but, you know, that's something that's a very straightforward exercise. And, in fact, it takes me a page to go through it, so it's really not that difficult. I'll put it down here. So if we calculate the curvatures, okay, so the point that comes out of here is that when we talk about those components of the space-time connection, we find agreement with purely intrinsic connection on the hypersurface. But those components bring extra information that's not purely intrinsic, but has some extrinsic component to it. And notice, by the way, that you only have non-vanishing components of the connection when you have one or zero time entry here. There are no TT components. It works. It just works like that. Okay, curvatures. That's 1, 2, 3. So there's a bunch of stuff that you can calculate. And the idea is that you go back to the previous expressions for gamma that are valid off the hypersurface, and then we're going to differentiate those and then combine them in quadratic forms and things like that. And eventually, we're going to evaluate the end result on the hypersurface. So on sigma, what we find is the following for all the non-vanishing components of the Riemann tensor. There are components of the Riemann tensor that have two time entries and two spatial entries. Of course, once you've committed that to T, this cannot be T, right? Because you have the anti-symmetry property of the Riemann tensor and the same thing here. So this can be T, but this cannot be T. You can interchange them. But essentially, if you have two time entries, the other ones must be spatial. So you got that. And as the result of the calculation, you find that this involves the second time derivative of the spatial metric, and then something that involves the square of the extrinsic curvature. So that comes from differentiating the gammas. This comes from squaring the gammas. When you sum over all the indices, you find that T, you know, a t-term like this will multiply a t-term like this, and you bring out squares of extrinsic curvatures. So that's for this. Then we have possibilities where there's only one time entry and all spatial entries in the Riemann tensor. And this involves, and that's interesting, we have the intrinsic covariant derivative of the extrinsic curvature in this anti-symmetric combination. So the way that the covariant derivative in spatial sense answers this result comes from squared gamma terms. So when you expand this out, you find that it's going to be a bunch of partial derivatives that will combine with these guys in the appropriate way to form a covariant derivative. And what you end up with is a very nice looking tensorial expression for this involving a spatial tensor, something that lives purely on the hypersurface. It's a tensor on the hypersurface that comes from external information, but if it's purely on hypersurface, differentiated covariantly as a surface tensor ought to be. So we got that, and finally, we got all the spatial components of four-dimensional Riemann tensor, which will involve purely intrinsic components of the three-dimensional Riemann tensor to build, from spatial method. So this is the Riemann tensor that you get from H alone, and that's the purely intrinsic notion of curvature on the hypersurface. These are the spatial components of the four-dimensional Riemann tensor, and there's important distinction between the two. And in fact, the distinction is very important because while I've not done that, I have some terms that I need to write down. So in this case, we don't have agreement between the spatial components of the four Riemann tensor and components of the intrinsic Riemann tensor. And the difference has to do with the extrinsic curvature. So just to be clear, those are the spatial components of the space-time curvature tensor. And those are the purely intrinsic curvature obtained from the spatial curvature. And there, I think we see a very important distinction between what is intrinsic curvature and what is curvature inherited from the underlying space-time, the projected components of the full space-time curvature tensor do not agree with the intrinsic curvature tensor. There are terms that are important that come from the extrinsic curvature. And that opens up all sorts of possibilities. For example, you could have, let's think of surfaces, surfaces embedded in three-dimensional space, for example. I could go down one dimension, turn this four into a three, and talk about a two-dimensional surface embedded in three-dimensional space. For example, let's think of a sphere embedded in three-dimensional space. A sphere has curvature, so this is not zero. But the underlying three-dimensional manifold is flat, so this is zero. So we need the extrinsic curvature to guarantee the validity of that equation. In a case like this, where you embed a curved surface in a flat manifold, the full curvature tensor is zero. The intrinsic curvature tensor is not zero, and essentially the equation balances itself so that the extrinsic curvature and the intrinsic curvature combine together in the appropriate way through this equation to guarantee that the full curvature tensor is zero. The Riemann tensor of the embedded space is zero. So that equation is rather important, and the distinction between what is intrinsic curvature and what is extrinsic and the relationship between the two contained in that equation is rather important. What's interesting about the set of results is the fact that apart from this guy, everything we have here involve tensors that live purely on the hypersurface. What I mean by that is that once we've defined the extrinsic curvature to be that, the time derivative of the metric evaluated at t equals zero, we are dealing with a tensor that lives on the hypersurface only. So all of those curvature quantities involve either the intrinsic metric or the extrinsic curvature. The only extra bit that we get after we take the extra derivatives in calculating the Riemann tensor are contained here. And those, and this contains second derivative information, and it's not surprising that the Riemann tensor should involve second time derivatives of the metric. That's the sort of thing you would expect to arise in evolution equations if you set up your initial data on a hypersurface and you wish to evolve it forward in time. The evolution equations would have to be set in order in time. So we see that arising. Okay, so everything is clear so far. Okay, so once we have the Riemann tensor, we can go to the next step and start truncating indices and calculate the other tensors like Ricci and Einstein. So let's just quote results for that. I'll leave this there. And I don't think I'll bother writing down results for the Ricci tensor because we won't need it immediately. But you just proceed through the usual route. You start, take traction of indices, you calculate the Ricci tensor, you calculate the Ricci scalar, you combine these things into the Einstein tensor, and then you'll end up with something like this. The four-dimensional Einstein tensor has TT components that are given by this expression right here. R is the Ricci scalar of the hypersurface. It's the intrinsic Ricci scalar that is built from the purely spatial metric. So it doesn't have four on it to indicate that it's a purely intrinsic Ricci scalar. Plus a couple of extra terms involving the square of the extrinsic curvature and the square of its trace. I'll find the notation in just a second. The time space components of the Einstein tensor involve derivatives of the extrinsic curvature and of its trace. And that's it. And the space space components of the Einstein tensor, well, that's a long expression, so I'll just write it out. GAB without the 4 on it is the Einstein tensor you would get starting from the three-dimensional metric going through all the procedure. So it's the purely intrinsic notion of the Einstein tensor. But then there's a whole bunch of extra terms. We have second time derivatives of the metric, surprisingly, they have to show up somewhere. And then because the Einstein tensor involves taking the Ricci scalar and removing the trace and all of that stuff, well, we get something analogous showing up here. So here we have a term like this that comes out from the construction of the Einstein tensor. And then we have k-square terms. Like that, we have this, and we have that. So it's a bit of a mess, but that's okay. Those are all the components of the Einstein tensor broken down in this 3+1 language, where we have a bunch of things that live purely on the hypersurface, like all the H's and all the K's, the Einstein tensor, and so on, but something a little bit extra that comes from the second time derivatives of the metric.
For 4GAP.
Oh, sorry, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So what we have here is that RAB would be the intrinsic Ricci tensor that we would construct straightforwardly from the spatial metrics, so it's the purely intrinsic Ricci tensor. R, of course, would be the trace. And GAB would be, well, the three-dimensional Einstein tensor that has exactly the same definition as the four-dimensional one, except that I'm using H here. And then K is the trace of the extrinsic curvature, but it's a trace that's defined in the purely spatial sense. And we got that. If we were dealing with, so those equations are pretty informative, and we'll spend some time talking about them. if we were doing things in a slightly, you know, in the different context where the surface is time-like instead of being space-like, then instead of talking about time-time components, we would be talking about, you know, LL components where L would be the proper distance orthogonal to the time-like surface. And we'd get, you know, equations that look almost identical to that except for a few sign changes. And I think one thing that would happen is that, well, this equation would come from an overall minus sign, and there would be other sign changes here and there. And one book has, you know, all the epsilons in place, we can easily, you know, read off the results. But essentially, you know, all the calculations are more or less identical, but the signs turn out to have some importance when you want to actually write down something that, you know, that, okay. So there's a lot of information in all of this. And so far, I've brought out all that information by using specific coordinate construction. But before I proceed with the discussion of what this all implies, what I would like to do is to, you know, remove the coordinate construction from the four efficient field equations. So I can now try to think and go back to a way of writing this all out without having to rely on the space-time coordinates that I've chosen. So I can try to write this all out in sort of in a way that would be generally covariant with respect to changes in space coordinates. We still have all the freedom here at retaining the covariance in terms of the space coordinates. What I want to do now is to undo the explicit construction of the coordinates and try to recast all of this, or the, you know, important part of all this, in a sort of space-time covariant way. And it turns out to be very easy to do. And the key in order to do that is to, let's see, do I still have, no, I don't have that anymore. The key to do that is to remember that in the coordinate construction that that we have, well, the time direction is essentially the direction of the normal vector. So instead of talking about time components, we can just say components along the normal vector. And you know, as soon as we do that, we remove the need to talk explicitly about time component. So I could do so in that specialized coordinate system that I'm dealing with. We had this simple expression for the normal vector, which was simply the gradient of the proper time coordinate. And also in the coordinate system that I was using, so I should put a star here just to call attention to the fact that this book is valid on coordinate system. And in this case, well, the tangential vectors are partial derivatives, which means that in that case, we just get a bunch of ones and a bunch of zeros in that coordinate system. We get a one if alpha is the same index as A, and we get zero otherwise. And in fact, that's the key to going away from the specialized coordinates, because again, when I look at all my four-dimensional quantities, I can say that what is a time-time component of a four-dimensional tensor is in fact the components of that tensor in the direction of the normal vector, and I've achieved what I wanted to achieve. And instead of talking about time-space components, I can talk about components along either the normal and the tangential vectors, and those would be fully tangential components of my vector. So it turns out to be very easy to go from here to a fully covariant expression for what's going on. So that's what I'll do in the next step. And then I'll give you more analysis of what all of that information actually means. Okay. So let's see, where do I want to go? There. Let's return to that all-important quantity k that I call the extrinsic curvature. I forget which number this is. This map. Four. Thank you. Okay. So the extrinsic curvature was defined well, essentially in two different ways. First of all, I said it's something that happens to be equal to a component of the condenser. So we can think of that as the definition, or we can think of this as the definition, it's the time derivative of the metric evaluated on the hypersurface. And because pay is so important, there must be ways of defining it in a way that, you know, doesn't rely on connection evaluations from the coordinate system, or the notion of a time derivative that also relies on coordinate structure. And in fact, there are easy ways of converting all of this into fancy differential geometry language that removes the need to talk about a specific coordinate system. So let's do that first. So KB was defined either as this or as that. And what I would like to do is to turn these statements into something covariant. Well, if I'm going to talk about K in relation to a component of a connection, presumably K has to do with the covariant derivative of something, because that's how you bring out the connection, by computing covariant derivatives. So, and it turns out that the right approach to this is to consider the covariant derivative of the normal vector. So let's consider, that's kind of derivation that no one likes. Consider something that will actually give you the right answer at the end. So why do you consider that? Well, because you know where you're going, because you read, that in the textbooks, you know how to go about this. It's not terribly satisfying to go like this, but, let's do it. So consider. What I'll do is to take the normal vector. For now, I'm thinking in an arbitrary coordinate system. I'm going to take the covariant derivative of the normal vector, project it down onto the hypersurface. And that's important because I know the normal vector on the hypersurface only. Initially, I'm dealing, and in fact, in this context, I'm dealing only with one hypersurface, and the normal vector is a vector field on that hypersurface. I can differentiate in directions of the hypersurface, but I wouldn't know how to differentiate it in directions off the hypersurface. So when I consider something like this, I don't exactly know what I'm talking about, because I'm talking about derivatives that may be on the hypersurface or off the hypersurface, and only know about how to differentiate on the hypersurface. When I combine it with that, though, it's clear that I'm only interested in directions on the hypersurface, and there's no ambiguity associated with that quantity. I want to make this clear now. I want to bring this up now, because later on, I'll actually try to extend the normal vector off the hypersurface using the coordinate construction. It will have some limited importance for what I want to say next. But anyway. So those are perfectly unambiguous quantities, and we can, evaluate that. This is a scalar quantity as far as space-time coordinates are concerned. Here we have a tensor that is being combined with two vectors to form a scalar quantity as far as space-time coordinates are concerned. It's a tensorial quantity as far as hypersurfaces coordinates are concerned. But that's okay. The fact that I'm dealing with a scalar quantity as far as space-time is concerned means that I can evaluate this in any convenient coordinate system. And the fact that I get in that coordinate system will be guaranteed to be valid also in all coordinate systems. So we have a favorite coordinate system, we'll do the calculation there, and we'll verify that this is indeed equal to that.
Some significance for all alphas and all betas, right? Otherwise, I don't know how to think about that thing, right?
Well, what saves you is really, so if you wanted to think of this as an isolated object, you would run into that trouble. You would have to come up with, one way of extending the normal vector width from the hypersurface, and then you would essentially define what you mean by the derivative in those directions. I think the key is to not try to think of this as an isolated object, but try to think as a whole package, as one thing that doesn't care to be individuals. The same is true when I write down when you write down the GDZ equation in this form, if you only have one GDZ and you think of this as an isolated object, you run into exactly the same problem, because the velocity vector is not defined off the GDZ. And therefore, it's derivative off the GP if I'm not defined. So this isolated is ambiguous, but as soon as you multiply by that, you'll be carefully worried about derivatives on the GP, and it becomes ambiguous.
So, those little notation issues, but it's just that, it's just notation issues.
Okay, so let's evaluate this in our preferred coordinate system. And, regardless, we can expand out the covariant derivative. Like this. So at this point, I haven't specialized anything. But if I now use the coordinate construction, well, I know that the components of the norm vector are constant. You know, there's minus one entry and zeros. So the derivative of the normal is zero. So I get rid of that. And in fact, the only time component that I've got, did I get the minus sign here? I should put that, yes. Yeah, it's a minus sign. So when I do the summation over gamma, the only answer that I pick up is the time entry for the normal vector, which is minus one. So I get rid of plus of minus one that's here. And what I need then are the time space components of the connection. So here I'm using the explicit expression we have there for the normal vector in the shape of coordinates, and I'm using also the explicit expressions we got for those. And when you're done with the calculation, you get that this covariant quantity is equal to that coordinate system, is equal to that. And that's the thing that we said was the definition, one of the definitions for the explicit curvature. So, this is a tensorial quantity on the hypersurface in terms of the spatial coordinates, but it's a scalar quantity as far as the time, as far as the space-time coordinates are concerned. We have equality of two scalars in one coordinate system that guarantees equality of those scalar quantities in all coordinate systems, and from this we can conclude that, in fact, a proper covariant definition for the explicit curvature is one that can be written in this form in terms of the covariant derivative of normal vector. One aspect of this that's not entirely obvious is that this quantity right here is actually symmetric under an exchange of A and B. Well, that comes out of the calculation, but it's not obvious when you stare at this that if you exchange A and B, which is equivalent to exchanging alpha and beta here, that you would pick up the same result. But in fact, it turns out to be true. So it's not obvious, but it's true. So the point is that when you look at this defined equation, you have to do a little bit of work to convince yourself that extrinsic curvature is a symmetric tensor, but it does come out. That's one way of proving the result. In the book, I have another way of proving the result. Okay, so that's one way of defining the extrinsic curvature. What I would like to do now is to look at something that would be more closely analogous to this way of defining the extrinsic curvature as the time derivative of the metric. And now we have to think, what possibly we mean, you know, in geometrical terms by the time derivative of the method. Well, presumably it would mean something like derivative in the direction of the norm vector. So now how do you make that precise? Any suggestions? So presumably we don't want to take the partial derivative of the metric in the direction of the normal vector. That would be highly non-tensorial. So what possibilities do we have? Yeah, and we have to we have to get a tensor out of that, right? Well, scalar in that case, out of that. So, what? Lead root, right? Well, essentially, there are two things you can try. You can take the covariant derivative of the metric, the direction is normal, but that gives you nothing. Or you can try the lead derivative of the metric, and that probably will give you the right thing. So let's try that. Let's consider the lead derivative of the metric in the direction of the normal vector. Well, this is simply this when you work it out. And if we project this, in the tangential directions, well, you end up with two, the symmetric part of this quantity projected in the tangential directions. And they're each equal to KPV. Well, here we see that this is obviously symmetric under exchange of A and B, because if I exchange A and B, it's equivalent to exchanging alpha and beta, and this change. So the result clearly will be symmetric. Here the symmetrization is obvious, but the fact that, you know, each term here, each projected part of this is equal to itself, to each other. That's the less obvious statement, but in any case, it's all true. But now we have another way of defining extrinsic curvature, which here really conveys the meaning that we're talking about the normal derivative of the metric in the tangential directions. It's not an alternative definition because, in fact, it's, you know, it's just exactly a restatement of the previous definition. But here we have this nice sort of interpretation in terms of how the metric changes in the direction that's normal to the hypersurface. So it's an interesting way of expressing this part of the equation. Okay. What I want to get at, so I'll do similar things later on. So, for example, the this component of the Einstein tensor a little bit later, I'm going to rewrite as the normal component of the Riemann tensor, and here these guys will become the normal spatial components of Riemann tensors, so we can convert all of these things also into true, space-time scalars by combining a space-time tensor with a space-time vector in the appropriate way. So all of those statements can be made fully covariant by just introducing the appropriate vectorial basis. But before I get to that, before I explore the meaning of those equations and those equations, what I want to do is to, try to bring out a little bit more intuition about the meaning of the extrinsic curvature. As in this equation right here, we have the essential piece that the extrinsic curvature really depends on. So it really tells you what the metric is going to be doing as you go slightly above or below the hypersurface. It's really the variation of the metric in the normal direction. And that tells you something about, you know, the bending. You know, it really conveys information about how the surface is actually bending in space-time. So you may know the metric at one instant, but what it's going to do at later instance is something that tells you about how, you know, the surface is actually bent, shaped as viewed in the overlying, embedded space-time manifold. But it's a very important quantity, so I really want to try to bring as much angles, as many angles as I can into its description. Some of the angles will come from this very important equation here, you know, gives the distinction between the projected components of the four-dimensional Riemann transfer and purely intrinsic ones. And we'll have occasion to play with that a little bit. I'll reconsider that example of a sphere that has intrinsic curvature and extrinsic curvature that all combine appropriately to give zero curvature for the embedded space. So we have a vision to return to that, but before I get to that, so what I want to do here is to consider a different kind of issue. Okay, so let's just go on with it and see what happens. We're at number four, this is number five. So I want to talk about tangent vector fields. And what I mean by that is a tensor that, you know, it's going to be a tensor field that's defined entirely on the hypersurface. And it's going to be purely tangent to the hypersurface so that it will be decomposed into, purely a tangential decomposition. So essentially, all that I mean is that we have a tensor that lives in space-time, but in fact is a prisoner of the hypersurface, which means that it sticks to the hypersurface, it's defined only on the hypersurface, and it only has components in the tangential direction. So in the, you know, in the preferred coordinate system, there would be no time entry, and there would be, you know, only spatial entries in that area. That's what this decomposition is telling us. So that's what I mean by a tangent vector field. And what I would like to consider here, and I go back to the relationship between connections here, what I would like to do is to take this vector and consider it to be a space-time vector, and I want to covariantly differentiate it as a space-time vector. And then I want to compare that to what I would get if I were to differentiate this as a pure space vector, or a vector that lives purely on the hypersurface and covariantly differentiated with respect to this, you know, hypersurface notion of connection. That's the exercise I want to do. So I want to consider this, but here I have to be careful because I don't know how the vector extends away from the hypersurface. So the only components. The only components to the derivative of the vector that I can consider are the ones that are going to be in the direction of the hypersurface. So I can talk about the tangential derivatives. I cannot talk about the normal derivatives because I don't know how the vector is going to behave away from the hypersurface. It's not defined away from the hypersurface, and therefore the normal derivatives are not defined. So this is an unambiguous quantity. I can calculate this, and well, this would be it. Well, let me do it in the fifth coordinate system. If I expand out the covariant derivative of space-time, I get this, and I multiply this by the tangent vector. And this one I have plus. The other one I had minus because it was a lowered index. Right, so here I was differentiating a lowered index tensor. Okay, so here we know what we're talking about. We're talking about purely spatial derivatives of my tangent vector field, so no problem here. And here, what we have, so gamma can only have spatial value, and beta is being forced here to be equal to b. So what we got here is something that looks like that. The key observation here for what I'm trying to do is to notice that alpha initially can take, well, alpha can take values 0, 4, 1, 2, 3, right? So A doesn't have a time entry, but it's entirely conceivable that this derivative quantity could have time entry. And in fact, we know that this can have time entry, and that's the point of what I'm trying to get. Let's look at alpha equals t. If alpha equals t, what we get is the statement that the time component to that equation is going to be equal to, well, this is nothing, right? Because A doesn't have time entry, but this does. And this involves the extrinsic curvature. So that equation has a time component that causes the extrinsic curvature. The spatial components are what you would expect. Here we get the spatial component of A differentiated, and the four-dimensional connection reduces to the three-dimensional connection when all the indices are spatial. And what we get here is what we find to be the extrinsic curve, the covariant derivative of A viewed completely intrinsically. So what's the bottom line here? Well, if I reconstruct a covariant expression for all of this, what I get is that this vector has a tangential component, but also a normal component. And the tangential component, of course, is what we just computed here. But the normal component is what we just computed there. Let's see, how do I write this normally? And that's an interesting equation because it tells you that even though your vector field is purely tangent, even though it lives and sticks to the hypersurface, when you differentiate it and view it as a space-time vector, its derivative in space-time, even though you take the derivatives in the right directions, the derivative, the differentiated vector in space-time is not purely tangential. The bending of the surface of space-time generates this additional normal component. And that is entirely, and that's entirely produced by the extrinsic curvature. And, you know, if you try to draw pictures of what's going on here and try to see geometrically what happens, what you'll see is that, well, if the surface is actually bending in space-time, you will see, you know, you will get something like that. I will try to draw a picture because I'm very poor at drawing pictures. But you can attempt that yourself. You can sort of try to imagine two situations, one where the surface is flat and not bending in the underlying manifold, and one where it is bending, try to compare the two situations. And you will find that when you have bending in the embedded manifold, you find that this operation that I've described here will generate an normal component to a differentiated vector. And that is, you know, in a correspondence with the existence of extrinsic curvature. So that's one way that you can actually, this is one calculation that you can go through. And in the book, that's what I do. I actually introduce the extrinsic curvature through this exercise that reveals that, you know, there's more, when you differentiate tangent vector fields, you might expect that all the operations would be purely intrinsic because you start with things that live purely on the hypersurface are tangent to the hypersurface, but in reality, when you work it all out, you find that no components do arise. And the quantity that generates that, well, certainly is important, has a deep geometrical meaning. And that's what we're striving to identify. Yep.
One of the interesting things maybe you're going to say, but presumably the same thing holds the connection. And that's what accounts for the fact that even though the spatial parts of the connections in both cases are the same for the three versions,
right,
nonetheless, the curvature is different.
That's true.
So looking at derivatives of connections.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Well, here we're not looking at here we're only looking at connections, right? And essentially, what this is telling us is that, well, there's more to life than just the spatial connection and what's going on, and the mixed components of the connection actually do have an influence when you do these things. But of course, you know, when you continue this and you start differentiating, you get more aspects of this which are revealed in those equations, right? Okay, so that's one point that I wanted to make. And okay, and I think in the maybe 5 or 10 minutes that remain, what I'll do is to I'll just rewrite those equations here in fully covariant form. But maybe I don't need to. Well, let's just rewrite them so that we have them recorded somewhere. So when I look at all these results that I obtained previously, it's going to be pretty easy to recast those two equations in a covariant form. And we'll do that, but I'll do it here because for this one, while it's not so easy, here I have a second time derivative of the metric. I would have to do some notation for this. I would have to relate that to something more meaningful, like the second derivative of the metric. I'm sure all of that could be done, but it turns out not to be all useful to pursue this. So what I'll do is to rewrite those equations in covariant form in the same way that when I rewrote the equations up here in covariant form, I didn't try to do it in this case, again, because we have all of those second derivative terms that would require a little bit more imagination to recast the covariant form. But in any case, that's six. Those equations that I'm going to write down are pretty famous and important in differential geometry. They're called Gauss-Kudatsky equations. And Gauss-Kudatsky equations are essentially this relationship between what is space-time curvature to what is purely intrinsic spatial curvature. Of course, Gauss and Kudatsky probably were thinking not so much in terms of space-time, three-dimensional hypersurfaces. They were talking about, two-dimensional surfaces embedded in three-dimensional space. But here, the dimensionality of the manifolds really don't come in at all. So the results are completely general. You don't care about the dimensionality. But anyway, the statement of the Gauss-Kudatsky equations, first of all, is the statement that if you take the fully space-time Riemann tensor and you project it down all the way down to the hypersurface in all of the spatial indices, so that's the covariant expression for what I used to mean by the spatial components of the Riemann tensor. Well, what you get is the intrinsic Riemann tensor plus all the k-squared terms. And the other one that you can write down easily is the previous one, which here involves tangential and normal components. So I'll write it like that. So here I'm taking a contraction first with the normal vector and then with all the tangential vectors. And in that case, we get covariant derivatives of extrinsic curvature and the appropriate symmetric combination. And at the level of the Einstein tensor, I would resolve down to 4, but let's do it here again. So for the Einstein tensor in the purely normal directions, we get half r minus k squared plus k squared. And finally, for the mixed time components, here I have it, index A, we get the covariant derivative of K. And so those are the sort of fundamental Gauss-Kabetsky equations. And those are the contracted forms. And those are the ones that, as I said before, can be written down easily without having to worry about the double derivative pieces, which would require more structure, more rewriting. And I'm sure it could be done. But as I said, it turns out not to be all that useful. So when we come back this afternoon, what I'll do is to consider a few simple examples of how to look at embedded surfaces in higher dimensional manifolds. And I'll describe a few simple calculations of the intrinsic curvature. And then I'll describe the sort of the influence of the Gauss-Kabetsky equations. I've talked about the sphere. I think I'm going to work it out in full. Just to show that, well, it's possible to have curved surfaces in flat spaces. It's also possible to have flat surfaces in curved spaces. All that's possible. But what you need to satisfy in each case are, those requirements that come from differential geometry. So the interplay between space-time curvature and spatial intrinsic and extrinsic curvature is something that, well, is, not for choice, you can't choose, those are fundamental equations that restrict freedom of, that you have in embedded surfaces, and they're very important. Some people have played the game trying to come up with four-dimensional space-times that could be considered to be hypersurfaces in flat five-dimensional space-times. So here you set up yourself a goal of coming up with a four-dimensional manifold with a certain amount of intrinsic curvature and extrinsic curvature, but such that five dimensions, the left-hand side, would actually vanish. But it did not for some special situations, very high, very symmetric situations. And chapter 3 in the book, they give you one example of this. I think you can embed a de Sitter space in a five-dimensional flat space-time manifold, completely flat, Minkowski five-dimensional manifold. In general, though, it can't be done. So that's a beautiful theorem of differential geometry that, in general, you cannot expect to embed a four-dimensional manifold in five-dimensional flat space-time. When you go from two dimensions to three dimensions, there's no obstacle. You can embed any curved surface in a flat three-dimensional space without any concrete problems. When you move up dimensions, the number of constraints that those equations give you become prohibitive. And the general statement is that, well, if you want to embed a four-dimensional manifold in higher dimensional space, I think to do it in algebraically, you have to have at least 10 dimensions, if not more. I forget the details here, but anyway, you need a lot of extra dimensions to be able to put a curved four-dimensional manifold in flat embedded space-time. So, those issues have been sort of discussed by mathematicians over the years, and there's some interesting mathematical issues. I think for us, the interest of this equation is really in studying type surfaces, and one major application of all this that I'll turn to this afternoon is the initial value problem of general relativity. So if you think of formulating GR as follows, first you specify initial conditions for the metric, then you evolve them in time the way that you would formulate any field theory. So the question is, can you pick what are the initial conditions you need what is the complete specification of initial conditions that will give you well post problems, first of all? And the question is, are there constraints that need to be satisfied on the space of initial solutions or of initial data? And so I'll talk more about that later on, but you know, there's an analogous situation with E&M. So in E&M, you have evolution equations for the electric field, and then you have to start with an initial configuration for the electric field. That's not completely arbitrary because it has to satisfy the divergence free condition. Well, in GR, they're analogous things. So they're conditions that will be represented by the induced metric and extrinsic curvature. And those things cannot be picked at will. They have to satisfy a certain set of constraint equations that are, in fact, contained in those things here, in those equations here. So I'll talk about this more, but it's a rather important application of this formalism. Another application that I've indicated is the issue of constructing junction conditions. So what if you try to glue spacetimes together, what are the appropriate junction conditions that allow you to do that in a smooth manner? We have enough equations on the board to be able to decide what is appropriate and get that this afternoon. All right, so that's pretty much.